This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Breakfast team had a chance to sit down with Mark Sayers. Now, he's written a number of books, including the most recent one called Strange Days, about kind of the church existing in a chaotic world. And I never heard really the term futurist, but the idea being is that he kind of spitballs the idea of what the church would look like. And I thought, well, you know what? Let's just start out in the present. And so my question to Mark was, how do we make sense to live as faithful Christians in a world that seems to be very chaotic and dangerous?
Yeah, well, terrorism is something that, you know, has been around for around 150 years. And really, you can chart terrorism's growth to the rise of the media. And it was a way of getting attention through using violent acts, which then would get picked up by the media. And we're seeing that increasingly in our day as media is everywhere. We now have cell phone videos of straight away when there's an incident almost anywhere in the world. So terrorism is something which its effects are amplified because of the imagery. Our actual chance of being killed in a terrorist attack are absolutely minimal. I think the stats are you're more likely to fall off a ladder and be hurt than be killed in or injured in a terrorist attack. Nevertheless, it's frightening because we as humans see the human faces in those tragedies. And ISIS at the moment, one of their strategies, their sort of military strategies, is called getting people out of the grey zone. They want to get people out of that grey zone and into either hating Muslims, and they want to get moderate Muslims into this anti-Western space. So they're manipulating this to get us to move to an extreme. So I think as believers, we need to understand that we're not to give in to fear, that we need to understand that this is actually something used to manipulate us and to maintain that truth that Christ gives us peace. The world is a chaotic place, but we follow someone who's overcome the world.
So part of the challenge with that, like I just went to the Philippines and I was actually really nervous about doing that, even though the issues were in Mindanao and Cebu. You still have a moment like that. You're trying to tee up a European holiday and you say to yourself, do we want to go to Barcelona or Paris? Because you see stuff like that. It's obviously on some levels having an effect on how we look at travel.
Yes, yes, totally. And again, too, that's because as humans, we're far more affected by stories than we are by statistics. So, for example, the story out of Barcelona and the horrible story of the Australian boy who died, and look at some international papers, a similar thing in different countries where you follow the family and you think about the terror of losing your child. But statistically, we're more likely to die driving to the airport for our overseas holiday than we are in going to some of these places. So it's keeping that in perspective, understanding how we work as humans, but also realizing that this is to manipulate our emotions. So our world increasingly, particularly our digital spaces, are a very emotion-filled space. And everyone from corporations to terrorists are trying to manipulate our feelings.
Okay. One of the things we see kind of as a result of what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan is this kind of massive outpouring of refugees and kind of human displacement all over the world. Obviously, that affects our local shores where we're looking at, how do we protect immigrants? How do we do immigration effectively? How, as believers, should we respond to a refugee crisis that now numbers in potentially, tens of millions of people?
With an issue like refugees, like so many other issues in the world, it's so utterly complex that the media and politicians like to sort of boil it down into this very binary yes or no thing, stop the boats, build a wall, when actually the issue of refugees is extremely complicated. The war in Syria and Iraq is extremely complicated. So you've got this incredibly diverse, different reasons that are sending people into becoming refugees. One of the things that the UN did after World War II was set up a process for people to be refugees. And I think one of the things that happened recently was that sort of was thrown into chaos a little bit when Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, sort of opened the doors, if you like, in a very, it's trying to be a compassionate response, and Merkel is a Christian. But a lot of people then felt on edge because it seemed that system to process people had been ignored. She herself looks back and says she would have done that in different ways now. So that's been used, I think, particularly by lots of different groups then to sort of, make a political talking point. What's happening on the ground behind that media story of, you know, refugees or anti-refugees is really an incredible thing. And it's happening from literally from Iceland to New Zealand, which is that Christians are taking refugees into their churches, some are even into their homes. And the church and Christians are really at the absolute forefront of providing places of hospitality for those who find themselves displaced without a home. And there's an incredible thing happening where churches, particularly with a lot of Syrian refugees, there's churches in Scandinavia, which all of a sudden are becoming healthy and vibrant for the first time in decades. So there's this really interesting thing, I think, that God is doing in the background and a good news story in the midst of the refugee crisis.
It works well when Christians are doing lovey-dovey things and investing and caring like that. But it doesn't work well when we seem to be outspoken and disagree with some really central politics in our own backyard. And I think of an incredible debate I saw between Reagan and Bush from like the late 80s, completely disagreed on just about every single policy, but had this mutual respect and understanding for other people to allow them to have the platform to speak. Around the ideas of marriage and gender identity, we've lost the ability to have fair and rational debate. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's happening across the Western world. I think part of that is a result that Western culture and many cultures were basically places where people would meet each other in what some people call mediating institutions. You would go to your local union or local footy club or, you know, just even on your street, in your neighborhood. And in those places, different people had to negotiate and be good neighbors with others. So we learned really good skills on, you know, how do you talk about sensitive subjects? Australians would classically use humor around these things. And just, you know, how do you respectfully be friends with someone who is different to you? As our world becomes more isolated, as we increasingly hang out in what people call digital ghettos, where just the nature of the internet means we only are surrounded, the algorithms make us surround ourselves with people who believe the same stuff, increasingly we find ourselves distant from those who think differently.
Yeah.
And so in many ways, that sort of fiery rhetoric you see online still, and there's that battles that you see, and even you just think about how comments underneath the news articles set people up against each other. But really, we still spend most of our lives in the real world. People still spend picking the kids up from school, going to the supermarket. Most of us still have to exist in that world where we negotiate these things with wisdom. It's just that they're devalued by our society. Australia is an incredibly multicultural place. With people with all different kinds of world views. And so I think, you know, outside of that media bubble, people are still doing that well. It's just that the sort of current digital landscape makes us think that everything's fiery, when in the real world, I don't think it is as much.
I mean, one of the things I think about is that old Voltaire quote that I might disagree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. And I just wonder if when we disagree with someone, we use, you hear hostile language like bigotry or hatred or a phobia, when the reality is it is possible to strongly disagree with someone but still maintain conviction and love, isn't it?
Totally. And I think that, you know, Voltaire and that idea came about because people like Voltaire understood that whilst you may think some other speech is, you know, hateful, if you pass laws around that, the next guy in power could use those exact same laws to silence you. So there was this element where there had to be digestible some kind of speech which, you know, we found offensive. But that's to actually to protect everyone, because those laws, and they did in places like the Soviet Union, got used against people to shut them up. The Christian angle, I think, takes it to another level, that a lot of our Western multicultural, multi-religious society actually comes out of a Christian vision. People like Roger Williams in, I think it was Rhode Island in the United States, who was a Protestant who'd experienced religious persecution, and, you know, his forebears had in Europe, wanted to create a space where people would not be persecuted for their religion, so people could believe anything. Oliver Cromwell, same in England. Oliver Cromwell, who was a Protestant, you know, allowed the printing of the Quran, allowed Jews free worship. So that came from this vision that whilst we may believe something different to others, that sort of Christian ethic of love meant that we can't coerce them to believe what we believe.
Mm. One of the things that I think about, like, as a futurist, is that what I'd like to do is kind of take a moment and say, you know, what do you think the three top issues are that's facing the church right now? Then what are the three top issues that you might perceive the church facing a decade from now, and then potentially 2 decades from now? Would you be kind of comfortable doing something like that?
Yeah, I'll try my best.
I like this as an idea, because I feel like if we've got a roadmap of the past and we kind of, you know, spitball a roadmap of the future, it'll kind of give us voice to where we need to be paying attention. Okay, so So, Mark, as a futurist, we're going to start in the present. What do you think are the three major issues that are going to affect the church today?
I think they're often not what we think. Like, often people will say, you know, this particular issue is before the church, but sometimes that's more because they're being advocated. I would say one I notice is the increasing fragility of Western people. So particularly when you look at generations emerging, and even people now, that we've increasingly been taught that anything difficult in life is harming to us, when most cultures have seen that actually character is built from difficulty. So we increasingly have emotional fragility in people, and that's at odds with the gospel. Paul spoke about, you know, when I'm weak, Christ is strong. Secondly, I would say a very different understanding of what it is to participate in an actual gathering of people like a church. So increasingly, we're commitment phobic, and increasingly, we believe we can belong to things and have lots of rights, but with minimum responsibility. And that's a huge effect, not just on the church, but that's a huge effect across, I think, all sectors of society, where we're less participatory than we used to be in the past. But particularly for churches which are built on volunteerism, that's a huge thing. And then the last thing I would say is, I think currently we're seeing that sort of politics came to the centre really for the last sort of couple of decades, but now it's pushing out to the left and the right. We're seeing this across the world. So Christians will find themselves, as the world gets more fractious and more polarised, being seduced by either messages on the harder right or the harder left. So watching those two things, I think, is going to be really key.
Okay, so Mark, you and I have just gotten a bit older and a bit greyer. We're now 10 years old. I'm, of course, now navigating teenagers in my life. What are the major issues in the church now?
I think that you're going to see an increasingly multicultural church, which is a good news story. But I think it's going to be really interesting where you've got this strong divide between a very strong multicultural church and then a native-born church, which is increasingly becoming secular. And navigating those tensions, I think, is going to be really, really interesting. Second, I think, is the role of an even more immersive digital space, where I just read some stats recently on, I think it's from Gene Twenge's new book, which looks at the first generation to grow up with iPhones. And it's staggering. You know, 2007, they come in, and everything from friendships to loneliness to self-harm has just skyrocketed since the advent of the mobile phone. What does that look like in 10 years? What does it look like with virtual reality? What does it look like when, if we're lost in our phones, what does it look like when we can completely enter into virtual worlds? And what does that mean for our young people and for us is a really big question. And the last one, I feel that in 10 years, the world is going to be more tense. I think we have a number of global hotspots, from the South China Sea to the Korean Peninsula, to the Baltics, to the Middle East. There's a number of hotspots where possibly we could get dragged into a conflict. It's the last thing I'd want to happen, but we're close in a lot of areas in a way we have not been for the last few decades. So what would a church look like where possibly there was major military conflict in the world?
Okay. Man, that's, yeah, that's good. Like, even when you have that moment when you're thinking on that, you're like, oh, there could be war in the South China Sea. Do we see Emperor Trump established? Do you know? I mean, it really is a big deal. All right, the last question I want to do kind of relates to the church and where it sits in culture. Is the best place for the church in the middle of culture or on the fringe of culture?
Yeah, great question. I think that, you know, I'm a big believer in something called creative minorities. That, there was an English thinker called Arnold Toynbee, and he said that cultures are re-energized by a creative minority who doesn't fit. And because they don't fit, even though they're part of the culture, they're able to see some of its idols. Mm. And because they're able to see some of its idols and some of its weak spots, they're then able to get rid of those idols and weak spots in themselves, and they're able to then bring that to a healing truth back to the wider society. So I think that the church will be a minority player in the culture that's to come. And I think that position of being a minority who is still strong and to actually serve the wider culture is a really powerful place to be. So it's a combination of being on the margins, but also then influencing at the center. In the book of Jeremiah, we see the people of God, the people in Judah and Israel, are taken to Babylon, where they're a minority, yet they get these really key influential roles as a different minority and actually bringing health to that foreign culture because they have this position that's marginal, but also influencing at the center.
Well, I can't help but think of the nature of the church in relation to that Paul passage in Corinthians that you shared, that for my grace is made perfect in your weakness. Therefore, I will delight all the more in weaknesses and sufferings and persecutions, for when I'm weak, you're strong, right? I mean, that almost seems to be the sense that when the church is suffering and finds itself on the fringe, there's a perfection of Christ's power.
Absolutely. And I think that's new for a lot of Christians, particularly a lot of younger Christians growing up, because we've been given the relevant message, which is basically let's become as relevant as possible and the culture will accept us and that's how we'll influence the culture. And I think that's now gone. I think it's now about building resilience. It's about how do we be resilient and serve the culture through being in that minority weakened position, as you said, that passage so eloquently explains.
Are we going to see a name change for Relevant Magazine to Resilient Magazine?
Well, maybe. You never know.
Mark, that was brilliant, man. Thanks for taking the time.
No worries. Yeah, loved it.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.